The sanctuary in Qom, protests in Tehran, and mediation between the Mashrute seekers and the royal court by moderate statesmen obligated the weary Qajar Shah and his court officials to dismiss the unpopular premier Ain al-Dowleh, whose draconian measures triggered the earliest protests. He was the third member of the Qajar tribe in a century to serve as premier and stir a crisis. Later, in 1908, his part in quashing the revolutionary resistance in Tabriz further blackened his image as a staunch reactionary. Shortly thereafter, the protesting ulama who had taken refuge in Qom returned after the Shah only implicitly accepted their demands. Yet on August 10, 1906, under increased public pressure, he could see no other way but to issue a rescript that came to be known as the Constitutional Decree, Farman-e-Meshrutiyet, addressed to the new premier, Nasrullah Khan Mashir ad-Dowleh. The receipt called for the establishment of a National Consultative Assembly, Majlis-e-Shura-e-Milli, to carry out the requisite deliberations and investigations on all necessary subjects connected with important affairs of the state and empire and the public interests, and shall render the necessary help and assistance to our cabinet and ministers in such reforms as are designed to promote the happiness and well-being of Iran. Although, ironically, the word Mashrute was carefully avoided in the rescript, the text did speak, albeit vaguely, of legislative reforms, and further endorsed that the Majlis, the first with any representation beyond the elite, be elected from among seven classes: the princes of the Qajar family, the ulama, the notables, ayan, the nobles, ashraf, the landowners, the merchants, and the guilds. The Electoral Law Committee, appointed to draw up election bylaws, consisted of mostly young, Western-educated bureaucrats. Among them were Mahdi Goli Hedayat and Hassan Mashir al-Mulk, later Mashir ad-Dowleh Pirnia. Liberal moderates with family histories of divan service over several generations. The latter was a graduate of the Russian Military Academy and a student of law who had founded the School of Diplomacy, Madrasaye Siyasi, in Tehran in 1899. Perhaps inspired by the model of the Estates General during the French Revolution, the committee opted for a representational system that surprisingly gave the greatest number of deputies, vakils, to the guilds and the merchants. Of the 168 deputies, Tehran was designated 60 seats, four of which were to go to the Qajar princes and nobles, four to the ulama and students, tollab, 10 to the khans and landowners, 10 to merchants, and one each to the 32 guilds. Azerbaijan and Fars were to receive 12 seats each, and the remaining 10 provinces 82 seats. By September, the electoral law was ratified, and the designated deputies began to convene in the capital. The inauguration of the Majlis in October 1906 aimed to frame the fundamental law, Qanun-e-Asasi. Remarkably, the issuance of the constitutional decree and the convening of the Majlis closely followed developments during the 1905 Russian Revolution and the establishment of the short-lived Duma in April 1906. Adopting the term fundamental law also seems to have been inspired by the fundamental laws issued by Tsar Nicholas II, according to which the Duma was granted limited legislative powers, but only with the ultimate endorsement of the Tsar, who called himself the supreme autocrat. Similar tension between the Majlis and the monarch was soon to emerge with the Iranian constitutional revolution. The members of the Electoral Law Committee adopted the term fundamental law in place of the French constitution, so as to avoid conservatives' accusations that they were adopting an alien institution contrary to Islamic Sharia and the tradition of monarchy in Iran. Yet the secularizing agenda of the constitutionalists, boosted by dissident preachers and the burgeoning liberal press outside the Majlis, was clear enough not to be missed by opponents, even though a handful of radical deputies, led by likes of Hassan Taghizadeh, the celebrated deputy from Tabriz, did their best to camouflage their anti-royalist and anti-clerical views. Fearing their opponents in the court and among conservative ulama, the Majlis deputies soon realized that to avoid the fate of the Russian Duma, which was dissolved in July 1906 by order of the Tsar, they had only a brief window of opportunity. The Majlis thus hastily drew up a document to be signed by the Shah on December 30, 1906, on his deathbed. The fundamental law recognized the separation of three powers, with the Majlis as the legislative body, far more than earlier demands for it to have a mere judicial function, and with the Shah as the head of the executive. The news of the revolution stirred some interest not only nationally, but in the European press as well. The Shah died of kidney failure on January 3, 1907, and was immediately succeeded on the throne by his son, Muhammad Ali Shah, reigned 1907-1909, a man of decidedly different temperament and political orientation from his father. Framing the Constitution. It was remarkable enough that Iran had convened a parliament against all the odds. It was even more significant that the Majlis not only framed a constitution, but soon after, in October 1907, ratified a substantial document, the supplement to the fundamental law. The latter document guaranteed basic liberties and laid the foundation for a constitutional system. This was achieved in an environment of growing tension with the court of Muhammad Ali Shah and open hostility from the anti-constitutional clerical camp under Sheikh Fazlollah Nuri, 1843-1909, who was allied with conservatives at the court. Despite his early support for the constitutional movement, Nuri soon parted ways, posing a potent challenge to the Majlis and the cause of constitutionalism. He coined the term Mashru'e, obviously mimicking Mashru'te, to imply that the Shar, that is, Sharia, and not the Shart, condition, ought to be the foundation of the new constitutional order. Though a prominent Asuli jurist, he did not articulate the meaning of Mashru'e beyond generalities. Perhaps aware of the past Shi'i jurists' aversion to engaging in issues of political governance, which in the absence of the Imam of the age considered any other form of worldly government to be categorically oppressive, Nuri remained in essence loyal to the theory of state-religion dual authority. Yet, facing the reality of a modern legislature, he strove to find a role for the jurists, with himself at the helm. Not merely a judicial one, but a role to enforce the Sharia far beyond its accepted limits. He viewed the nascent Majlis and its constitution as no more than a conspiracy hatched by heretics, Babis, and atheists, and he called on his clerical cohorts to oppose them. In his rescripts, La Voyer, periodically published from Shah Abdulazim, where he had taken sanctuary, he attacked as non-Islamic such precepts as freedom of speech and equality before the law. Once the appeasing gestures by the Majlis, including the inclusion in the constitution of a 5-member Mojtahid supervisory committee, appeared to be mere lip service to the Ulama, Nuri quietly abandoned the idea of the Mashru'e and became a royalist supporting Muhammad Ali Shah. Beyond Nuri and his supporters, the infant constitutional regime had to face the consequences of a new alliance between its European neighbours. In August 1907, Russia and Britain concluded an agreement that recognised two zones of influence for the powers in northern and southern Iran, with the middle region declared neutral. This was the first time such an agreement had replaced the old power rivalries. The agreement reaffirmed the powers' traditional guarantees for the Qajar throne, without acknowledging the Majlis or the new constitutional process. This generated new anxieties and, as it turned out, contributed to the precarious nature of the emerging order, and a year later, to the coup of June 1908 that destroyed the Majlis and suspended the constitution. The events that unfolded then gave the Iranians little comfort in the European powers' assurances that they would respect Iran's political sovereignty and territorial integrity. The first Majlis was composed of deputies with little legislative experience and misperceptions about how the Majlis, and indeed the entire constitutional system, was to function. Among the deputies, those of the Azerbaijan contingent were the most influential members. From the outset, a few deputies, most significantly Hassan Taghizadeh, 1878-1970, a young charismatic orator from Tabriz with a radical agenda, came to dominate the debates. Born in Nakhchivan, the southern autonomous region in today's Republic of Azerbaijan near the Iranian border, to a family of Shi'i local clergy, Taghizadeh started as a seminarian in Tabriz, but, soon becoming critical of traditional madrasa schooling, turned toward modern sciences and Western political thought. With the help of his cohorts, he established a small lending library in Tabriz, a means of self-education also aimed to enlighten his fellow citizens. He later left for Beirut and Cairo, where, still in clerical attire, he was further exposed to current trends of secular thought and nationalism. He also perfected his Arabic and learned some English and French. He returned to Tabriz at the beginning of the constitutional era and was designated a deputy from Azerbaijan. The Azerbaijan contingent was in part backed by the semi-clandestine socialist circle in Tabriz and by the Iranian emigre community in the Caucasus. Many were dislocated peasants from Iranian Azerbaijan, but there were also enthusiastic Iranian merchants and wealthy industrialists who offered their moral and financial support. Other deputies from the provinces, including Isfahan, Kerman, Fars, and Gilan, added to the Majlis credibility as the first nationwide legislative body created by the will of the people. The two constitutionalist mojtahids heads, referred to as the two glowing starts, Nureyne Nayereyn, attended the Majlis session not only as representatives of the ulama class, but also as surrogates for the so-called recognized religious minorities. Only in the second Majlis, after 1909, was a Zoroastrian dignitary elected to represent the long-persecuted followers of Iran's indigenous religion. The Jewish and Christian communities also appointed representatives, but the Babi Azalis, or Baha'is, were never elevated beyond the level of despicable heresy. Neither were women considered worthy of standing as deputies, or even being part of the electorate. The supplement to the fundamental law was inspired by the French, Belgian, and Bulgarian constitutions, but in substance was adopted to the requirements of the Iranian environment and the precepts of Shi'ism. It reflected contingencies and contradictions inherent in the Iranian system that were hard to overcome. Yet every article of the constitution was genuinely argued and heatedly debated in open sessions and before enthusiastic audiences. One of the most remarkable aspects of the Majlis was indeed its openness, even though at times the deputies of the guild and mercantile backgrounds were intimidated by the oratorical skills of such leading figures as Taghizadeh. The fundamental law and the supplement to the fundamental law declared a division of powers into three branches. The Shah was acknowledged as the head of the executive, whose divine grace was bestowed on him by the will of the people. This was the first time in the long history of Persian kingship that a document subordinated, albeit partially, the king's authority to the people's institutional mandate, an assertion over which a bloody civil war would soon be fought. The constitution also regarded the Majlis as the legislative body in charge of making laws, but also delegated to it supervisory powers over the affairs of the government, including consent in appointing the premier and his ministers, as well as the prerogative to dismiss them. To appease detractors within the ulama camp, the constitution stipulated that all laws, qanun, legislated by the Majlis, was to remain within the bounds of political order, and thus outside the sphere of the Sharia. In reality, however, it subverted the accepted universality of the Sharia in some key provisions. In contrast to Islamic law that discriminated between Muslims and non-Muslims, the constitution recognized equal rights for all citizens. It further secured freedom of the press and publication, and freedom of association, so long as they were not against principles of Islam. Freedom of expression in particular was seen by the opposing ulama not only as a clear breach of restraints that Islam placed on individuals, but also as sanctioning the spread of un-Islamic ideas and heresies. Article 1 of the 1907 Supplement to the Fundamental Law specifically declared Twelver Shi'i Islam as the official religion of Iran, and Article 2 specified, "At no time must any legal enactment of the Sacred National Consultative Assembly, Majlis Mogadas Shoraye Meli, established by the Imam of the Age and His Majesty the Shahanshah of Islam and the whole people of the Iranian nation, be at variance with the sacred principles of Islam or the laws established by His Holiness the Best of Mankind, that is, Prophet Muhammad. This, of course, was not merely a lip service. It reflected the framers' serious dilemma of how to reconcile the will of the people of Iranian nation as a source of the constitution's legitimacy with the ancient pillars of authority, Shi'i Islam and Iranian kingship. After much bickering over the language, to appease Nuri and the Mashru'eh opposition who were battering the constitutionalists from their sanctuary near Tehran, the Majlis approved, after several drafts, that a committee of 5 mujtahids and experts of Islamic law would oversee the compatibility of legislation with preconditions laid out in the Sharia. Though in reality the committee never convened and was forgotten after 1910, compatibility with the Sharia remained an issue that would re-emerge 7 decades later during the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Other articles of the Constitution betrayed the same undercurrent of obsequiousness in fear of being labelled irreligious. Article 8 of the same document granted all the people of Iran equal rights before the law, a milestone for Iran's political culture. The equal rights were spelled out in the following articles in specific terms, including the safeguarding of lives, properties, homes, and honour from every kind of interference, and prohibited arbitrary or extrajudicial arrest, detainment, and punishment of all citizens, as well as infringement in their private dwellings and confiscation of their properties. Beyond basic rights to life and property, Article 18 declared freedom of the study of all sciences, arts, and crafts, unless forbidden by the law of Islam, and Article 19 demanded that the government establish public schools and supervise public education. More significant, Article 20 allowed all publications, except heretical books and matters hurtful to the perspicuous religion of Islam, and exempted them from any censorship. In the same spirit, Article 21 sanctioned freedom of all societies and associations, provided that they were not productive to mischief to religion and state, and are not injurious to good order. The Majlis was also under great pressure to limit the sovereign's power. The division of powers, a cornerstone of any modern constitution, had to be manoeuvred against anti-constitutional Muhammad Ali Shah and his dubious ambitions. The constitution's crucial Article 27, which assigned legislative, judicial, and executive powers to 3 branches of the government, granted nominal power to the Shah. The king's executive power, known as the Laws of Ordinance, were to be carried out by the ministers and state officials in the august name of His Imperial Majesty in such manner as the law defines. Moreover, Article 44 exempted the Shah from any political responsibility for the affairs of the state, instead holding the ministers of the state responsible to the legislative branch. Under enormous pressure from the court, however, the framers of the Constitution were obliged to assert in Article 35 that the sovereignty is a trust confided as a divine gift by the people to the person of the king. It is reported that Muhammad Ali Shah only agreed to sign the supplement to the fundamental law in October 1907, after inserting in his own hand the phrase, as a divine gift, rendering the article obsolete. Majlis versus the monarch. Conferring the divine gift to the Shah in the Constitution reflected the constraints and trepidation of the Majlis, just as the provision to convene the committee of the Mujtahids to oversee legislation did. However, it would be an error of historical judgment to assume that the fundamental law and its supplement were merely loose translations of European constitutions. The Iranian constitution was shaped article by article, after hours, days, and months of fierce debate in and out of the nascent parliament, and the proceedings of the Majlis is witness to the heated exchanges between deputies, as well as the sincere optimism with which they engaged in debates. All the more remarkable, this was a document produced by a Majlis unaccustomed to the traditions of the Magna Carta, the Long Parliament, the civil and constitutional refinements of John Locke, Montesquieu, and John Stuart Mill, and the tradition of legal procedure and secular humanism that had engendered the 1787 Constitution of the United States, the 1789 French Declaration of the Rights of Man, and the 1791 ratification of the American Bill of Rights. The deputies of the Majlis and the people who elected them to office soon realized, as did the English, French, and Americans, that a constitution and constitutionalism did not come easily or cheaply. The mashrouteh and implementation of the fundamental law resulted in much bloodshed, political conflict, and the chaos of a civil war before being acknowledged as a revolution, Engelab. The term in Persian originally denoted a seasonal climatic change or a sudden shift in human medical condition, of the same root as the Arabic verb gebla, to turn. Only in the late 19th century, and more clearly during the 1908 to 1909 civil war, Engelab acquired its modern political meaning and gradually came to replace constitutional movement, Nahzat, in the revolutionary discourse. However, as early as 1907, the shift in and out of the Majlis toward greater radicalization anticipated nothing less than a full-scale revolution. Between May 1907 and July 1909, the Majlis at every turn faced enormous threats to its very survival. A range of issues contributed to the instability of the nascent constitutional regime. Chief among them were disagreement on limits of the legislative authority, growing tensions with the Shah and his court, and a constant barrage of defamatory propaganda from Nuri and advocates of the Mashrueh. Unrest in the provinces, provoked by the court and by the powerful tribal khans and the local ulama, as well as serious skirmishes and sectarian fighting on the Ottoman borders, further challenged the young order. By mid-1907, Azerbaijan was being harassed by the royalist Shahseven tribe in the vicinity of Ardabil, who, provoked by the Qajar Shah, pillaged towns and villages in the name of securing the crown. Further to the west, in the Aramiya region, Kurdish irregulars, backed by Ottoman troops, repeatedly crossed the border and attacked Assyrian and Armenian villages in Iranian territory. In Fars, Isfahan, Zanjan, and Kashan, urban unrest, sectarian clashes, and banditry were on the rise. Naib Hossein, a former member of the Qajar rural police turned bandit, together with his gang, since the late 1890s organized repeated raids on the city of Kashan and villages in its vicinity stretching as far east as the central Iranian desert. Posing himself as a friend of the poor and the underprivileged, in reality he was no more than a ruthless plunderer and killer of innocent people, whose reign of terror lasted for more than two decades. Failure to quash the Nayabis, as they came to be known, epitomized the weakening of the central government during the revolution and its aftermath. Under these circumstances, it became painfully evident to the Majlis and its radicalized supporters among the revolutionary societies, Anjumans, that no peaceful solution was in sight. The return of Amin al-Sultan, the shrewd premier of the Nazari and Mozaffari eras, to the post of prime minister in April 1907, provoked various reactions from the constitutionalists. Some viewed the reinstatement as Muhammad Ali Shah's design to forge an anti-Majlis front consisting of the court, the conservative Mojtahids, headed by Nuri, the tribal chiefs, and the patronage of the Russian legation, with which the new premier was reputed to be on excellent terms. Amin al-Sultan's claim to mediate peace between the Majlis and the Shah won him few supporters among moderates in the Majlis, but it also angered the radicals, especially once it became evident that he was financing Nuri's anti-Majlis operation in the sanctuary of Shah Abd al-Azim. His assassination in front of the Majlis in August 1909, at the hand of a young devotee affiliated with a socialist revolutionary cell with connections to the Iranian emigre community in the Caucasus, was a shocking development. The act, perpetrated by a small-time moneylender originally from Tabriz, was justified in the eyes of the plotters because of the fear of the return to power of the crafty pro-Russian statesman would soon result in the closure of the Majlis and destruction of the revolution. Weeks before Amin al-Sultan's assassination, the pro-revolutionary orators in Tehran had called for the premier's removal as the opening act of an inevitable revolution, a term with a peculiarly fresh ring to Iranian ears. The person presumed to be behind the clandestine cell was Haydar Khan, later known as Amu Ugla, but also known as Bombi, bomb maker, an Azerbaijani emigre trained as electrical engineer in Tiflis. He was employed by Tehran municipality to run the capital's first tiny electrical power plant. A Marxist revolutionary, motivated by the Baku oil workers' labor movement and radicalized by the botched Russian Revolution of 1905, Haydar Khan a handsome and charismatic man of persuasive character, would come to play a distinct and arguably destructive part in Iran's dissident politics over the following decade. The assassination of the premier on August 31, 1907, coincided with the signing in St. Petersburg of the 1907 convention, recognizing two zones of influence, clearly drawn diagonally across Iran's map. The agreement, part of a larger understanding between the two powers, also included Afghanistan and Tibet. With an ironic ring to its curious wording, the agreement was only a step short of occupation, at least on paper. Although the two powers had the temerity to announce it to the Iranian government a month later, the press abroad and at home had already drawn public attention to its ominous consequences. Most evident was Russia's free hand to force its wishes on the Iranian government in every way possible, including military intervention, especially in the adjacent provinces of Azerbaijan and Gilan. Even before the conclusion of the agreement, Russia repeatedly threatened to dispatch troops to Tabriz under the pretext of protecting the interests of its citizens and protégés in the face of revolutionary chaos. The agreement only made such threats more real and, as far as the powers were concerned, blatantly legitimate. Iranian constitutionalists were dumbfounded. Facing Russia's hostility, Iranian constitutionalists in and out of the Majlis hoped for British support. Yet the combined effect of Amin el-Sultan's assassination and the conclusion of the Anglo-Russian agreement dissuaded Britain from lending its support to the Iranian cause. New geopolitical realities, above all the rise of Imperial Germany, were the chief motive behind the 1907 agreement. One outcome, so far as Iran's domestic politics was concerned, was a greater polarization of Iran's revolutionary politics, which, less than a year later, led to open confrontation with the Qajar Shah and a civil war. The anti-constitutional camp consolidated once influential courtiers joined hands with the Mashru'e supporters. There was also strong regional support for anti-constitutionalists. The Russian Tsar, Nicholas II, reigned 1894 to 1918. Alarmed by the revival of the 1905 revolutionary spirit at Russia's southern borders, threw his moral weight and military support behind the Qajar throne. And so did Sultan Abdelhamid II, having been equally terrified of the mounting discontent among his officer corps at the very outset of the Young Turk Revolution. That he dispatched troops to the Iranian frontier to back the marauding Kurdish irregulars, who looted and killed Azerbaijani and Assyrian Christian villagers, may be viewed as token enmity toward the Iranian constitutionalists. The constitutionalist camp, though nominally abiding by the Majlis, was increasingly disillusioned with its slow course of action and the compromising attitude of its many deputies. The radicals among the deputies and outside the Majlis were supported by the revolutionary societies known as Anjomans. Members of the Anjomans, some of them armed with small weapons, assumed the task of guarding the Majlis, but also acted as a pressure group, dictating their wishes to the legislature. Whether former Barbies, nationalists or socialists, the Anjomans' leadership came to play a decisive role in the political process. By mid-1908, there were at least 70 Anjomans in Tehran alone, with an estimated 5,000 armed fighters. Best known among them, Anjoman-e Azerbaijan acted as a political party and a paramilitary force, and was the political agent for the influential provincial council in Tabriz, known as Anjoman-Ayalati Azerbaijan. The mouthpiece of the constitutionalists and their supporting Anjomans was the budding press, which had multiplied since 1905. They made explicit demands of the Majlis, attacked the Mashru'e camp and the court, and criticised the Shah for not complying with his constitutional duties. By 1908, more than 18 newspapers were in circulation all over Iran, as well as a vast number of tracts and clandestine posters. The journalists were of varying quality. Some, like Mirza Jahangir Khan Shirazi, 1870-1908, an intellectual from a Babi family, created the influential weekly Sure-e Esrafil, Seraphim's Trumpet, and set the tone for liberal constitutional debate with intelligent editorials. The columns by a gifted satirist, Mirza Ali Akbar Ghazvini, with the pen name Dehoda, 1879-1956, offered a vivid portrayal of revolutionary politics and current affairs through the eye of a witty Ghazvini village headman. Other papers, particularly Habl al-Mateen, Strong Cord, published in Calcutta since 1893 under the editorship of Jalal ad-Din Ma'ayyad al-Islam Kashani, 1863-1930, and his daughter, Fakhr al-Sultan, and during the constitutional period in Tehran and Rasht, placed Iranian constitutionalism in a broader regional context and amplified its international significance. The thrust of most newspapers, however, focused on political education and advocacy of secular modernity, invariably tied up with emphasis on Iran's window of opportunity to liberate itself from the slumber of centuries of ignorance and oppression by authoritarian institutions. The subtext was more drastic. It was as though, between the lines, they were calling for the removal of the old institutions, the Qajar kingship and the Shi'i establishment, and even a secular republican order. The passage of a press law in early 1908 that allowed for greater freedom of expression in turn brought more direct attacks on the Shah and the royalists. Beyond the press, the Anjumans were successful in mobilizing not only the guilds and merchants of the bazaars, but also a new class of government bureaucrats and even telegraph, post and Tehran's transportation workers. The state employees were willing to go on strike in support of the majlis. Remarkably, the Persian telegraph system, manned primarily by sympathizers of the constitutionalists, created under the government's nose a semi-clandestine communication network. The telegraphic network connected constitutionalists and their Anjumans all over the country, thus allowing for the rapid exchange of ideas and decisions, calling on the majlis deputies to act quickly and admonishing them for compromise and indecision. It reinforced a sense of national accord all over Iran, from Tabriz and Rasht to Isfahan, Kerman, Shiraz, and Kermanshah. The virtual national community created by telegraphy was already in place during the 1891-1892 tobacco protest. Thousands of telegrams were exchanged in the relatively short revolutionary years, often instantaneously and with the sense of empowerment that the new technology offered. A huge volume of messages exchanged in all directions, between constitutionalists in the provinces, the ulama in Iran and Iraq, the government and the provincial authorities, the Shah and his officers, the foreign representatives and European capitals, the majlis deputies and the Anjumans, the leaders of the bazaar, the Caucasian revolutionaries and socialists of Tabriz. Likewise, a vast number of complaints, petitions and messages of both support and protest were transmitted from the ordinary people in remote towns and villages throughout Iran, who had found a new voice through telegraphic communication. The press and the telegraph, both modern means of communication in the public space, elevated the majlis in the eyes of the people to a sacred institution, as the epithet sacred, Magadas, attached to the full name of Consultative National Assembly, denoted. The majlis became the embodiment of lofty goals of the constitution, expected, quite unrealistically, to dispense social justice, to ensure peace, prosperity and security, and to defend the country against foreign intrusions, all goals far beyond the frugal means of the majlis and the competence of most of its deputies. Yet, despite inexperience and inefficiency, the majlis record was still impressive enough to alarm its opponents and ensure continued animosity. Beyond the drafting of the fundamental law and its supplement, the majlis had tried, with some success, to tackle the urgent overhaul of the state's frail finances and arcane practices. By 1907, Iran's total state revenue was about 7,700,000 tumans, about $20 million, whereas annual expenditure for that year was projected at 10,700,000 tumans, $27,500,000, a deficit of 37%. The foreign debts that had accumulated since the 1890s only added to the burden. By 1909, it amounted to a colossal $30 million, with cumulative interest to be serviced by acquiring new loans. Greater dependency on imports added to global inflation and increased trade deficits. As much as the majlis tried, it shaved a mere 400,000 tumans, $1 million, from state expenditure. It abolished the ancient land tenure, tayal, system, an important move that nevertheless in practice proved largely symbolic. Most tenured lands were already incorporated as private estates during the Nasseri and Mozaffari periods, and were soon to be ratified in 1910 by the legislation of the Second Majlis. The pensions of the Qajar princes and hereditary bureaucratic elite were also reduced or terminated altogether, an act of greater consequence for the decline of a sector of the nobility that was devoid of private estates. The court budget, too, was cut to a mere 75,000 tumans, an act viewed by the Shah as a deliberate offence against the monarchy and its public image. Yet he and his weakling court could do nothing but wait. For the time being, the climate was not in their favour. Popular support was for the Majlis. On other items of the reform agenda, the Majlis record was less impressive. Efforts to create a national bank and national army faltered. Ending the monopoly of the British-controlled Imperial Bank of Persia over the issuance of Iranian paper currency and its grip on Iranian finances, only to be rivaled by the Russian-controlled Mortgage Bank of Persia, had long been a national aspiration. The Majlis' hesitation to establish a national bank was motivated less by insufficient capital, lack of expertise and misuse of the funds, pretexts under which the measure was eventually abandoned, and more by fear of injuring British financial interests at a time when the Majlis needed that great power's unsparing support. The creation of a uniform national army seemed even less of a tenable proposition, given the other imperial power's vested interest in the Russian-trained and Russian-backed Cossack Brigade, the most effective of the forces in the Qajar army. The coup d'état of July 1908 reaffirmed Russia's use of the brigade as an instrument of violent repression to sustain Qajar rule. The coup and the destruction of the Majlis. In February 1908, two bombs were thrown at Muhammad Ali Shah's cavalcade. At least four were killed, and the royal automobile, one of the earliest in Iran, was damaged, but the Shah escaped unharmed. The failed assassination, apparently masterminded by Haydar Khan and carried out by Azerbaijani émigrés from Baku, made the Shah even less secure about his survival on the throne. His suspicions were aggravated as rumours circulated in Tehran of the candidacy to the throne of his uncle, Prince Zell al-Sultan, whose raw ambitions for the Qajar throne were long the subject of popular speculation. It was starkly clear that the Qajar nobility, afraid for their own survival, were no longer unanimously behind the Shah. As early as mid-1907, radical constitutionalists, especially in Tabriz, called on the Majlis and the public to remove Muhammad Ali Shah from power. The revolutionary newspapers and preachers were no less shy. By early 1908, it appeared that an armed confrontation between the parties was inevitable. In fear of the revolutionaries, armed with light weapons, especially in Azerbaijan, the Shah was encouraged by his Iranian generals and his former Russian tutor, by then his advisor, to react. More decisively, the Russian commander of the Cossack Brigade, Colonel Vladimir Liakhov, was able to persuade the Shah that destruction of the Majlis and the Mashruteh was the only way out. Liakhov, a career officer who epitomised the brute autocracy of the Tsarist era, with a particular taste for violence, seemed to have been motivated by the January 1905 Bloody Sunday clampdown on the revolutionary movement in Russia. As the commander of the Cossacks, he was in a position to coordinate the Shah's intent with the wishes of the Russian authorities in Tiflis and St. Petersburg, perhaps even the approval of Tsar Nicholas II himself. Russian authorities were anxious to wipe out a revolutionary movement that could reignite unrest in the Caucasus. To them, the fall of Muhammad Ali Shah seemed a dear loss, not only because the Iranian radicals and the Baku revolutionaries would have gained the upper hand, but also because it could potentially strengthen the chances of the pro-British Zell al-Sultan. Once the Shah stormed out of the Golestan Palace in protest and began to fortify himself in the Bagh-e-Shah royal compound to the northwest of the capital, it became evident to all but a few reconciling deputies of the Majlis that the royalists were preparing for a violent showdown with the Majlis, the Anjumans, and the advocates of republicanism. The Shah was surrounded by the Cossack elites and regular troops, who were anxious to move against the Majlis. In response, the armed supporters of the Anjumans, who identified themselves as Mujahids, Crusaders, took positions on the roof and minarets of the Grand Nasiri Mosque, later known as Sepah Sallar Mosque, adjacent to the Majlis. As a consolatory gesture, some Majlis deputies, still hopeful of reconciling with the Shah, managed to persuade most of the fighters to abandon their posts, hence inadvertently exposing the Majlis to an artillery assault. On June 23, 1908, Cossack forces, as many as 2,000 cavalry and infantrymen carrying four pieces of artillery, surrounded the Majlis and the roads leading to Baharistan Square. The remaining Mujahideen fighters were ready to engage, even though they were reluctant to aim at the Russian officers out of fear of graver consequences. Yet, once fighting started, they offered a fierce resistance that lasted 4 hours and cost at least 40 lives, mostly on the Cossack side. In response, Lyakhov ordered the bombardment of the Majlis and surrounding buildings. The Majlis building, a handsome early example of Perso-European architecture, was severely damaged. Having demolished the symbol of the constitutional regime, the troops swarmed in and looted whatever they could, as they also did with the surrounding buildings occupied by the Anjumans and their fighters. To intimidate the general public, the troops then embarked on a bloody campaign of rape, pillage and killing in the neighbourhoods adjacent to the Majlis. The Qajar cities were not foreign to government troops' harassment and ransacking neighbourhoods, yet the show of force by the Russian Cossacks was novel, the first to bear the ominous signs of a modern military coup. Taking advantage of the coup in Tehran, royalists coordinated efforts in Tabriz, Shiraz, Zanjan, Isfahan, Kerman and Rasht by clamping down on the constitutionalists. A handful of deputies were trapped in the Majlis, as well as the two Mujtahids, Sayed Mahamad Tabatai and Sayed Abdullah Behbahani, who had come to give their moral support and prevent the bloodshed. The journalist Jahangir Shirazi and the revolutionary preacher Malek al-Matakalimin, fearing arrest outside, had taken sanctuary in the Majlis. To escape, they cut a hole in the back wall and rushed to take shelter in the surrounding houses, only to be swiftly betrayed and rounded up, battered and arrested by the Cossack detachments. At least 30 of the most vocal revolutionaries were arrested and detained in the Bagh-e-Shah compound, where they were further beaten, interrogated, tortured and detained. The few who were alerted in advance of the ensuing coup, including Taghizadeh, took refuge in the British and French legations, and a handful managed to escape the capital and leave the country. The remaining deputies stayed home, unharmed. Two among the Bagh-e-Shah detainees, the revolutionary preacher Malek al-Matakalimin and the journalist Jahangir Khan Shirazi, topped the Shah's blacklist. They were unceremoniously executed by strangling shortly after their arrival in Bagh-e-Shah. Suspected of Babi affiliation, even though they most likely were both agnostics, they were easy and legitimate prey, used to instill terror in the hearts of the public. The other revolutionary preacher, Jamal ad-Din Isfahani, another Babi suspect who had fled the capital, was captured in the western town of Barajerd and swiftly put to death by the governor of the province with the Shah's approval. Two other journalists were murdered in prison. The rest of the detainees, including the two Mujtahids, were gradually released and sent into exile, and a few were employed by the Shah as go-betweens to the remnants of the Majlis deputies. The newspapers were all closed down, and the Anjumans were declared illegal. Two royal announcements proclaimed that, with the removal of the heretics and agitators, the Shah intended to restore the correct constitutional regime within 3 months. The royalist coup, the bombardment of the Majlis, and the executions had the effect of terrorizing the public into silence, at least in the capital. People began to go about their business again, and the Tehran Bazaar reopened with a sense of relief. With Nuri and his growing contingency of clergy fully integrated into the royalist camp, and having abandoned for the most part their Mashru'eh objective in favour of Qajar absolutism, there were hopes that Muhammad Ali Shah would consolidate his reign. Some sycophants among the Majlis deputies began to ingratiate themselves with the Shah, who liked to believe, at least for the sake of appearances, that he favoured the constitutional regime. He declared, in conformity with Nuri's propaganda, that he was against the prevalence of the radicals, heretics and anarchists. The royalists needed such rhetoric for domestic consumption, but also to improve their tarnished image abroad. Although the coup was welcomed in St. Petersburg's conservative circles, it was frowned upon in London and elsewhere. Save a handful of liberals in the Persia Committee, formed in October 1908 in support of the Iranian constitutionalists, the European public was prepared to forget about Iran and its revolution. Most significantly, the great scholar and supporter of Iranian revolution, Edward Granville Brown, protested the brutal clampdown in numerous pamphlets and newspaper articles. If it were not for the popular resistance that soon reignited in Tabriz and thereafter in Rasht and Isfahan, constitutionalism seemed to have lost. There was also a sense of relief among the public, who hoped to see an end to chaos and a return to the relative calm and security of earlier decades. Growing harassment in towns and villages by plundering tribal horsemen and armed bandits, and encroaching Kurdish irregulars and Russian frontier guards in the northern provinces, killed thousands and ravished the countryside. The Majlis failure to deliver remedies to the country's economic and social needs was an added source of public frustration. By the time of the coup, it was as though the whole mystique of the Mashrutah had been spoiled, if not lost altogether.